The leaders of an independent review board that investigated last year's deadly assault on the U.S. diplomatic mission in Benghazi, Libya, will testify before a House hearing tomorrow. Retired Admiral Mike Mullen and former Ambassador Thomas Pickering will appear before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee on Thursday, September 19th. Republican Representative Daryl Issa of California announced the hearing in a statement last Wednesday, the one-year anniversary of the September 11th attack that killed U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. The report released last December by Pickering and Mullen and three other reviewers found that systematic failures and leadership and management deficiencies at senior levels in the State Department meant security was inadequate for Benghazi and grossly inadequate to deal with the attack. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are going to talk about the Benghazi attack this hour with two guests who investigated the events on the ground and wrote a minute-by-minute account in the new book, Under Fire, The Untold Story of the Attack in Benghazi. We will welcome your questions for them at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guests, again, both co-authors of the new book, Under Fire. Joining us first, Samuel Katz, expert on Middle East security, international terrorism, counterterrorism, and special operations. He is the former editor-in-chief of Special Operations Report. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for being with us. And we are also joined by Fred Burton, former special agent with the U.S. Diplomatic Security Service, currently Vice President of Intelligence for the global intelligence company Stratfor. And good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with you, Fred Burton. Why did you want to write this book? What motivated you?
Well, having been a former special agent, I had investigated the last U.S. ambassador killed in the line of duty in 1988, and that was Ambassador Arnie Raifel, and I was a very young special agent at the time, probably 25 or 26, and dispatched from Washington to take a look at that horrific event. And then over the course of my career, I had consistently been investigating disasters after disasters, and I felt that the true story of Benghazi was not one of politics, it was one of the heroism and courage. Yeah. So Sam and I put our heads together, since both of us have written a lot about diplomatic security in the past, and thought it would be a good idea to tell the story from the agent's perspective and to stay away from the nasty Washington theatrics which have become center stage.
Why do you suppose, Samuel Katz, it did become center stage? Why was this such a flashpoint in Washington and in public discourse, for that matter?
Well, obviously, it was right in the center of a presidential election cycle. It was an attack that took place on the 11th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks against the United States. And I believe that the issue of an attack against a diplomatic compound, which, if you look at the historical perspective, is nothing new. Attacks against embassies and consulates and diplomats in locations around the world have been going on since the Nixon administration and before. But I believe that political elements saw this as a presidential moment of weakness, and they also saw this as a potential Jimmy Carter moment for Hillary Clinton, who is believed to be a candidate for president in 2016. So the political fury, the storms built in the days and weeks following the attack, and as Fred mentioned, he was a young agent who investigated the last U.S. ambassador. The sad reality is that we only tend to talk about the needs dangers of diplomatic security only after their bodies on the ground in some foreign and distant land.
Yeah. We will go through the account of what happened, but I did want to ask both of you, Fred Burton, do we need more hearings on what happened? We have another one coming up tomorrow.
And there's another one today. I do think that there are certain questions that the American public doesn't have the answer to. For example, there has only been one CIA officer that was actually on the ground in Benghazi interviewed pertaining to exactly what the CIA was up to in Benghazi. So the question really centers along those lines, are, does the American public have a need to know? I think that there's a lot of people that would like to know the answer to that question, but then again, is this just an inside the beltway kind of issue that is just fueling itself because of the politics surrounding what has taken place, not only with the last presidential election, but with the current churn over the Middle East and Syria. So I do think that more visibility into the specifics of our intelligence mission in Libya would be good to know.
And what do you think, Samuel Katz?
I think there is a lot that should be known. Obviously, because of the intelligence element of what was going on in Benghazi, perhaps there's a lot that shouldn't be known. But I think that ultimately the important thing, I think that the American people should take away, and one of the things, one of the real important stories that happened in Benghazi is that today, the day after the attack, the day before the attack, there were many potential Benghazis that existed throughout the critical locations, critical threat locations around the world, and that ultimately this nation relies upon small teams of individuals, in the case of Benghazi, young agents, who find themselves out of just the day-to-day operations of their jobs, located in a city that is void of any law and order, that's absolutely dangerous. And they are all of a sudden faced with the ultimate challenge and the ultimate threat. And now, in the wake of the political firestorm and theater that erupted, everybody's going to be second-guessing their actions, wondering what kind of political fallout will happen from my actions, when in reality, the young agents who were in Benghazi that night, the only thing that really was on their minds was how can they save the lives of Ambassador Stevens and Sean Smith, and how can they protect their own lives.
So how did you go about finding out, Fred Burton, the untold story?
Well, this is in many ways what guys like Sam and I do. We utilized our contacts not only within the Washington intelligence and security community, but many of our sources overseas that were in Libya on the night of 9/11 were extraordinarily helpful, as well as, which are referenced in the book, some of Sam's wonderful journalist contacts that were there during the events were just fabulous. So, and again, if you go back to how we got in this business, Sam, many years ago, was the first author to write a story about diplomatic security concerning our capture of Ramzi Yousef, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing, and the challenges that fell out of that. So we have a long history of being able to piece together exactly what transpired as it pertains to attacks on U.S. diplomatic facilities and internationally protected persons.
The book contains a lot of redactions. Who did that and why?
Well, I submitted the book for what is called pre-publication review to the State Department, and specifically to the Diplomatic Security Service. And the blacked-out redactions are requests from Diplomatic Security to protect certain operational security issues. That process is, to be blunt, somewhat miserable to go through. I'm sure many of your listeners that have been down this path, because you could have multiple offices inside any government institution say, well, I don't like what this says, or can you remove that? So then you get very late in the production cycle of the book business, and the publisher at that point is in a production schedule which doesn't mesh with any kind of government schedule. For anybody that's ever worked in the government understands that. So the ease of just blacking out certain material becomes one that's more process-driven versus an opportunity to re-edit certain text.
What was the political climate in Libya at the time of this attack, Samuel Katz?
Inside Libya was one of great confusion and disarray following the fall of Gaddafi. But you really have to divide Libya into two, the western and eastern portions of the country. The western portion was the more stable of the two halves of Libya. The eastern portion was quickly descending into armed gangs and chaos. The eastern portion of the country was notoriously known to have more of a fundamentalist leaning. There was an eastern city called Derna that was home to many of al-Qaeda's top commanders and fighters. And in fact, Gaddafi had tried for many, many years to crush the will and the capabilities of that city to produce fundamentalist fighters, to no avail. Benghazi had become a city with no host or centralized government, and obviously no centralized law enforcement entity to speak of. The city was controlled by militias and gangs. Some of the militias were very far-flung in terms of their anti-American and sentiments toward al-Qaeda. They were in the camp of al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, and some of the gangs and militias were a little less so. And it's often a very difficult quandary for any foreign government that has a representation in a city like Benghazi as to who do you trust. I think this gives the true definition to the term expeditionary diplomacy, where foreign policy and diplomacy follows events that are transpiring too quickly for there to be a more sanitized and modular approach. So Benghazi was a lawless city. It was a dangerous city. The threats were known. There were attacks that had been transpiring all summer following the CIA assassination of Yahya al-Libi, the al-Qaeda number two commander who was killed in Waziristan. And the signposts were along the roads that something was imminent. There was an IED attack against the U.S. consulate in Benghazi that caused great concern. But having diplomats in dangerous locations is not anything new. In the book, we reference this to a young agent at the time in 1975-76 who was dispatched to Beirut as a temporary duty assignment to enhance security at the U.S. Embassy during the Civil War. And he sent a cable back to Washington that said, you're shooting at us, they're rocketing this building, I can't safeguard these diplomats, we have to pull out. And the State Department sent a cable back a couple days later that said, we are in Lebanon and for a higher purpose, we're staying. And a few days later, the U.S. ambassador and the chief political officer were kidnapped and assassinated by Palestinian terrorists. So that higher purpose has dictated the presence of U.S. diplomatic posts and U.S. diplomats in critical threat locations for the last 40 years.
What was the security situation like at the consulate in Benghazi, Fred Burton, was there a call for beefing up that security going on prior to this attack?
Well, the security was poor at the temporary facility, which gets into how you define these facilities as to what is their standards for certain security requirements, such as set back from the street, how far the road is from the actual physical structure. This was an interesting location in that it was a residential villa that had really not been declared a formal diplomatic facility because, in essence, the area was militia-controlled. The physical security of the compound, there were some actual successes that, again, have been lost within the political rhetoric. For example, the Diplomatic Security Service Security Engineering Division had placed some very good surveillance cameras inside the compound, and one of the unsung heroes of Benghazi was a young agent inside a tactical operations center called the TAC, a command post, and he was able to see the bad guys moving about the compound and radio and message text that to the various agents as to the movements of the terrorists. And I think he kept everyone alive for a long period of time because he was able to see when the agents that were hunkered down were maneuvering around the facility when the location became under fire. But at the end of the day, we had an inadequate guard force on the perimeter that for the most part was unarmed, and we had no special agents on the perimeter doing counter-surveillance that, in essence, is looking for pre-operational surveillance indicators as part of the terrorist attack cycle. If, in fact, we had additional agents in Benghazi on the perimeter, I'm convinced that that would have been a lifesaver. They would have been able to see the terrorist attack unfold and provide enough time for the agents at the villa to cover and evacuate Ambassador Stevens and Smith from the actual compound and move them to another location.
And again, I know you're trying to keep the political spin out of this, but we do have Dennis and Hudson, a listener, emailing. Can your guests please address the Republicans' refusal to fund additional security asked for prior to the attack? Do you cover that? What exactly happened there? Was there a request? Was it denied? Was it because of funding? What happened?
Well, the State Department had not funded, Congress had not funded the State Department, in essence, for quite some time, which is not unusual in Washington. And in essence, one of the things we talk about here at Stratfor, and I've written about in the past, is the boom or bust cycle in this business. And it's, again, it's very cyclical in that you can look when I was hired in the aftermath of the Beirut embassy bombings in 83 and 84, and we had a huge uptick in agent hires. We had more money than we knew what to do with. And that's the kind of period we're in now. But if you look at Benghazi, it had hit a low point, and security funding was limited. And also bear in mind, too, that diplomatic security reports under a very bureaucratic system, and you will have to hunt for it on a flow chart. It reports up through what is called the management cone to the Undersecretary of Management, Patrick Kennedy. And in essence, DS doesn't have a seat at the table at the highest levels of the State Department. Although they have a lot of money because tactical gear and armored limousines and training costs a lot, they really have very little say as to whether or not this is a good idea or not for being in places like Benghazi or Mogadishu or other kinds of locations.
Why was Ambassador Stevens there? Why was he at this diplomatic facility in Benghazi during such a time of turmoil instead of perhaps a more heavily guarded area, Samuel Katz?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, but it also needs to be understood that the ambassador is the personal representative of the President of the United States in a foreign country. He's the chief of mission. He is the boss. His word is the word of God. If he decides that he needs to be in Benghazi for whatever reasons that wouldn't be necessarily transmitted to the agents who protect him, then he'll go to Benghazi. There isn't a security team that will dissuade him or can dissuade him. It is known that through his itinerary and documents that were found later in the rubble of the special mission compound, that he had some private meetings, which included a shipping company, and he had some public meetings. He was there to open an America House, which is a storefront sort of center where people can come and learn about the United States, use the internet, and explore all sorts of things about American culture, education, and society. So his visit wasn't a secret. It was known, and because it was a public event, it would have been telegraphed to many individuals. His last meeting was with the Turkish consul, and this, together with his meeting at a shipping company and the presence of the CIA annex nearby, has led to all sorts of speculation that perhaps Ambassador Stevens was participating in some sort of clandestine operation, perhaps even involving arms from Gaddafi's arsenal that were being shipped to Syria.
Mm-hmm. We'll take a short break, and we will get into the minute-by-minute account of what happened that night in Benghazi, and we will welcome your questions for our guests, Fred Burton and Samuel Katz, co-authors of The Untold Story of the Attack in Benghazi, Under Fire. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with the co-authors of the new book, Under Fire, The Untold Story of the Attack in Benghazi. And we welcome your questions for them, Fred Burton and Samuel Katz. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, let's start with, was there any indication on that night that there was going to be this attack? Samuel Katz?
Well, let's put the attack in context. Throughout the day, there were incredibly violent and very dangerous protests that were going on throughout North Africa and the rest of the Arab world connected to the notorious YouTube video. The demonstrations, it would be later learned, specifically the one in Cairo, was orchestrated by Dr. Zawahiri's brother, it is believed. So there was definitely a terrorist element to these protests. But the protests were very dangerous to the embassies because there's no security protocols in this world that will protect a location from being overrun by 50,000 protesters who want to set the building afire. So throughout the day, the State Department and the Diplomatic Security Service command centers were dealing with these very real, very dire threats. So when the word first came that there was shots fired in Benghazi, the assumption was that this was a connection to these protests earlier on. However, the agents who were posted to the special mission compound knew that there was no protest going on outside. And they realized from the moment the first shots were fired that the special mission compound was under terrorist attack. And they reacted accordingly and according to procedure. The agents displayed very cool heads. They were very courageous. And they did what was standard operating procedure to try and make sure that the ambassador and Foreign Service Officer Smith would be protected. And the attack caught the agents by surprise, as Fred mentioned earlier. There was no U.S. special agent on post doing counter-surveillance, watching the street, watching vehicular traffic, making sure that snipers weren't positioned across the street. They were operating with a skeleton staff, and security on the perimeter fell to a private contracted force of unarmed individuals and several militiamen from one of the lesser of evil militias that had existed in the city. So when the attack transpired, the agents ran toward their positions that were arranged, and one agent escorted Ambassador Stevens and Sean Smith to a safe haven that was located in the villa where Stevens was staying to try and buy time. Security at diplomatic posts is all about buying time. It's all about having windows and doors and gates that can withstand mobs and gunfire and even explosions that can hold out for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 45 minutes, and 60 minutes, waiting for the cavalry to arrive, waiting for help. The special agents assigned to such locations are police officers or federal law enforcement officials. But unlike a police officer in the United States where backup can be a minute away or a mile away, and in many cases for these individuals, they have to hold out because backup can be an aircraft carrier battle group 6,000 miles away.
Yeah. So how many attackers were there and how many security personnel were there, Fred Burton? Oh, I'm sorry. I had your mic off. Go ahead.
There were five Diplomatic Security Service special agents on the compound when the attack began. There was one agent inside a sleeping quarters section of the villa, which is a large estate, and he was actually in bed when the attack unfolded. There was another agent who I alluded to earlier was a true unsung hero here. He was in the Tactical Operations Center, the command post, the communications nerve center for the location. It's standard operating procedure in any protection detail, whether it be for the State Department or the Secret Service or wherever. And then you had three other agents that were on a patio. And the five agents knew they were under terrorist attack the moment the first round was fired. And that information was conveyed back from the Tactical Operations Center to the U.S. Embassy in Tripoli, as well as to the State Department Operations Center at Foggy Bottom, where you also have Diplomatic Security Service agents manning a 24/7 lifeline to the world. Mm-hmm. The actual numbers varied throughout the night of attackers. The fog of battle, so to speak, made it difficult to actually pinpoint exactly how many were on the compound. The initial wave was probably in the neighborhood of 25 to 30 heavily armed gunmen that came onto the compound. And then the mob started to ebb and flow through the remainder of the event, but the actual attack team was fairly large, and it was a sophisticated attack with the intention in retrospect, or the working theory intention was to probably kidnap Ambassador Stevens and hold him hostage. We know that the agents thought for a long period of time while they were there dealing with going in and out repeatedly while the villa was on fire that Stevens had perhaps been kidnapped. And that was their mental thought process at the time.
The villa was set on fire. It was thought that Stevens would exit the villa and then he would be kidnapped, or?
Well, he was lost in the smoke. The heroic agent that tried to lead Stevens and Sean Smith out at great personal peril went back and forth numerous times to try to find Ambassador Stevens and Smith. And the agents that responded as backup also did that. And at one point in time, they actually tied a tow rope from a armored car that they had to each other to go in and out because they had no fire suppression equipment. They had no Nomex gloves. They had no smoke hoods. Smoke hoods would certainly have made a difference here, but they were not there. So in essence, after going in and out repeatedly, they said, well, where the heck is he? He's not here. They had located Sean Smith's body and tried to resuscitate him to no avail. But they couldn't find Ambassador Stevens. So their working theory was the terrorists must have grabbed him.
Yeah. Talking about the agents knew right away it was a terrorist attack, and they notified the State Department immediately that it was a terrorist attack. So where was the cavalry, Samuel Katz?
Well, as per procedure, they contacted the U.S. Embassy in Tripoli immediately, and they informed the RSO, or Regional Security Officer, and they also informed the CIA annex, which was down a mile and a half down the road, because there had been a protocol in place where the CIA security staffers, as well as elements of the 17th February militia, would come to the special mission compound and assist in any tactical rescue or any emergency situation. The cavalry was in Tripoli. There was no immediate response that could have made it to Benghazi in time to save the lives of Ambassador Stevens or Ambassador Smith. I think we tend to view immediate response in Hollywood terms and in TV show terms. But in reality, sometimes these attacks, especially fluid attacks, slow down the mechanism of response, because a force has to be mustered that can be mobilized and ready to go. They have to have in-country clearances to operate in that country. They have to have the intelligence on the ground that enables them to not walk into a trap. The memories of Mogadishu are on the mind of any young and even an older staff officers in the Special Operations Command that remember how the rescue can become far more dangerous than the actual attack. And there was no force that was able to decisively and dynamically respond and pull the Americans out. There was no allied government nearby that had assets on the ground that could provide help. Whoever was there with a skeleton security staff of their own and the alliance of a nearby militia. So I think one of the true untold stories, and a story of enormous courage and sacrifice, was the fact that when word reached the U.S. Embassy in Tripoli, the staffers there worked feverishly to arrange a Libyan Air Force C-130 Hercules that would fly a force of volunteers, CIA staffers, and two JSOC operators who happened to be at the embassy to Benghazi to help out their comrades who were under fire. One of those CIA contractors was former U.S. Navy SEAL Glenn Daugherty, who, these individuals were true heroes. They didn't hesitate for a second when they heard that Americans were under attack. They grabbed their gear, they grabbed their weapons, and they said, send me, I'm ready to go.
Darlene on Facebook says, I heard that once Benghazi, the consulate, was under attack, help was requested, and it was turned down by the State Department. Isn't that what was testified to before Congress? Was it turned down, Fred Burton?
It was not turned down. And again, I think this is part of, depending on which side of the aisle you sit, you have a preconceived notion of what you want to believe. Sam and I have had a few negative reviews, for example, because the facts of the story don't fit some preconceived mindsets of perception on Benghazi. Conversely, I've done a lot of talks about this of late, and once you explain to people the systems and how they work, then they understand. So, and that was one of our motives with writing the story, is not the politics. The system is really not designed. The counterterrorism response system contrary to what people think, is not designed for the President of the United States to make a decision, or even a cabinet-level official. These are pushed down into, at the highest levels, usually what is called the Deputies Committee, the Deputy Secretary of State, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, provided you can find them and get them together. But it's really geared down even further to an office director kind of position where automatic systems kick into play. For example, one of the things that worked was the Marine FAST team dispatched from Rota, Spain. The Marines were geared up as fast as they possibly could and mustered aboard an aircraft to head towards Libya. Well, that takes time, and I think people have a failed sense of idea that these are things that can happen in 2-3 minutes. Systems take a long time to kick into play, especially with the military. One thing that did not happen, which I think is was just a human error failure, was one of the response teams from Andrews Air Force Base, called a FEST team, was not deployed. But if you look at the math from travel distances from Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland to Benghazi, that's a long flight. And whether or not they could have gotten into country quick enough to prevent the subsequent mortar attacks is one that we don't know the answer to. I'm a bit skeptical that they would have gotten there in time, because that flight usually is on a 2-hour lead. So best case scenario, that team deploys 2 hours after the embassy's under attack. I doubt very seriously they could have gotten to Benghazi to make a difference. But that's neither said nor done. Should that team have launched? Well, in retrospect, it probably should have. And at least the administration would not have been accused of not doing everything, even if you have to turn the plane around in midair. I've been on those flights before. I've gone into countries during these kinds of events. I've also been turned around in midair. So I think, again, fueled by fiction stories and Hollywood movies, there are perceptions that our military and our CIA is all doing. Well, they're pretty darn good if you give them some time, but they're slow to respond during emergencies that are real-time events.
We are talking with the co-authors of the new book, Under Fire, The Untold Story of the Attack in Benghazi. Fred Burton is a former special agent with the U.S. Diplomatic Security Service and Vice President of Intelligence at the global intelligence company Stratfor. And Samuel Katz is an expert on Middle East security, terrorism, and special operations. He's the former editor-in-chief of Special Operations Report and several other books. Do you have a question about what happened that night, about a year ago, in Benghazi? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking with the authors of Under Fire, The Untold Story of the Attack in Benghazi. And we're welcoming your thoughts, your questions. Boy, I have only 10 minutes to go here, and there's still a lot to talk about, and we do have a lot of callers. But let me ask you, Fred Burton, were changes made to embassy security after this attack?
Yes. In fact, one of our old very good friends that was involved in the capture of Ramzi Yousef, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing, was put in charge of high-threat protection. He's a good man. He knows what he's doing. Again, there has been some funding from Congress to beef up security at the high-threat posts. And in fact, today, the State Department has a new announcement out looking to hire additional special agents. So any of your listeners that would love to get in the business. Now's a good time to apply. But there are still systemic failure. For example, Patrick Kennedy, the Undersecretary of Management, still controls the Diplomatic Security Service. Until the Diplomatic Security Service gets elevated to an undersecretary position inside the Department of State, you are always going to have bureaucratic issues, bureaucracy, to the point that you can't respond nimbly to world events. So I'm not optimistic that Diplomatic Security Service can be fixed until that is done.
Let's take some calls. Rich in Rhinelander is with us. Hi, Rich.
Thank you. With all due respect, I do have a question. I'd like your guest to parse part of the transcript of the Senate or the committee hearings on January 23rd, when our freshman senator Ron Johnson questioning Secretary of State Hillary Clinton asks her about within hours, if not days, and many will recall, she says, when you're in this position, the last thing you want to do is interfere with any other process going on. And Johnson says, I realize that's a good excuse. And then what will be the very famous quote that we'll probably hear in the presidential campaigns of 2016, what difference does it make? We've got four dead Americans. I just appreciate it if your guests would just reflect on that Ron Johnson-Hillary Clinton exchange and what they make of the comment, I realize that's a good excuse.
All right. Well, Samuel Katz?
Well, the book, as we mentioned, does not delve into the political firestorm that happened after the attack. I believe that Mrs. Clinton was correct in saying that you don't want her making tactical decisions. You don't want the president making tactical decisions. There are people that have a far greater knowledge and experience and wisdom to do that. As per the what does it matter, I believe the context was what the motivation of the attackers was, and I think that that's where it stemmed. The political theater has become the story. When the story is an on the ground reality of what life is like for American diplomats and for the people who are there to protect them in these very volatile, very dangerous locations, we take the sacrifice and the service that these individuals provide for granted when nothing happens. And the moment there are bodies on the ground, all of a sudden we become very concerned. But I hope that one of the takeaways, one of the political takeaways of this, is that diplomatic security becomes part of everyone's subconsciousness when things are quiet, and that we maintain levels of security, even, as Fred alluded to, beyond the boom or bust cycle, so that we don't always have to be reacting. We can preemptively be intelligent and spend money wisely and apply resources and assets wisely so that we don't have to have these political debates, because the political debates ultimately, in my opinion, make us look as if we're more partisan than pragmatic. And safeguarding American lives needs to be a pragmatic approach throughout, regardless of which side of the aisle one sits.
I seem to remember that Secretary Clinton was reacting to the debate over Susan Rice saying that initially that this resulted from the YouTube video protests and not right away in public that this was definitely a terrorist attack. Terrorism or protest, would there have been a difference? And does that matter, Fred Burton?
Well, I think it certainly matters to the families of the victims. I can speak firsthand. It certainly mattered to the five special agents on the ground in Benghazi, as well as to the entire Diplomatic Security Service. And I think that we all say things at times we wish we hadn't. And I'm sure in retrospect, former Secretary of State Clinton would probably take back that comment that she made in testimony. But again, I get back to Sam's point. The agents don't have any say as to where they're going, much like being in the military. And the foreign policy decisions of being in places like Benghazi and perhaps even Mogadishu, which the State Department's looking at this moment, is the kind of decision that unless the State Department has a seat at the table, the agents have a seat at that table and say, look, is this wise to be in this kind of environment with this kind of terror threat? We recognize that it's important for our foreign policy interests to have a presence in these locations, but perhaps there's a little smarter way of doing things. Perhaps the United States ambassador should not be in these locations at these certain periods of time. Until the State Department agents have that ability to weigh in with expert advice, then we are always going to be setting ourselves up for failure or setting the agents up for failure.
Let's go to Suzanne in Madison. Hi, Suzanne.
Good morning. This is the first truly intelligent conversation on the subject that I've heard because it is stripped of politics, and I really appreciate what your guests have to say. My question was just partially answered, that being, do the guests believe that our personnel are stretched too thin globally to be able to really be fully protected, because it makes sense that you can never fully protect people in this kind of a setting? And what typically are the criteria that are used to determine where an American presence is established?
I'm afraid we only have a minute to go, so very briefly, Fred Burton.
Yes, we are strapped too thin, at least the special agents are. That's why they're hiring new agents now. But bear in mind that those agents won't hit the streets till 7 or 8 months going forward until they're actually hired. And yes, if you look at, for example, the military withdrawal from a place like Iraq, guess who fills that void? DS agents have to step in to protect all the official Americans there when the military goes home. So whenever you look at the military withdrawal of any location, you can think about the young agents that are out there filling that void.
And only 30 seconds for Samuel Katz to give us your moral of this story.
I think the moral is that this goes on day in, day out, and 99% of the time, the young agents who are out there use every resource at their disposal to make sure that the embassies and the diplomats who serve in them are safe. And this was a tragic chain of events, the confluence of a perfect storm that occurred. And I think that the way to honor the memory of those who were killed is to make sure that we do everything in our power to mitigate it from happening again.
Thank you both very much for being with us. Samuel Katz, Fred Burton, co-authors of Under Fire.